Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 89, titled Emptiness is Not Nothingness.
One talk that I have been giving lately, fairly often here and there, has to do with Buddha's status as the founder of a world religion. He's more normally considered that. And the great Max Weber, I don't have a lot of time today, so I have really only about an hour, but the great Max Weber didn't quite know how to categorize the Buddha, because unlike other founders of world religions, Buddha did not meet God, a creator God, and was then authorized by that creator God to found a religion, you know? On the contrary, actually, there's a story in the Pali Suttas where Buddha, well, not exactly Buddha, but one of the Buddhist monks did meet God, met Brahma, and he asked Brahma, since you created the world, then I want to know how it works and what's the nature of reality, how does it work? And at first God said to him, do you have an appointment?
No, not for the moment.
He said to the monk, he said, you know, I'm God and I'm busy. Do you have an appointment? He said, and the sutra. And he recited his titles, I'm great Brahma, etc., etc. And the guy said, no, I know that, I'm so sorry, but I, you know, he came in his akasha, you know, his manomayakaya, his body, his mind-made body, to heaven, you know, where Brahma lived. And several times Brahma didn't answer him. So then he left heaven saying, sorry to bother you, dear God Brahma, but then I'm looking for an answer to my question. So as he's leaving, then Brahma comes out outside and says, hey, wait a minute. And then he says, oh, excuse me, don't be mad, I'm sorry, I'm leaving. Yeah, but I can't send you away without answering your question. He said, the fact is, I didn't really create the world. I don't really know how it works. Please go ask Buddha. And then he said, I couldn't answer you in heaven because these other Devaputras there, they think, you know, I was the first person here when the new yuga came. And when they saw me, they looked at me and they said, Dada. And first I said, I'm not your Dada. I didn't create. I don't know. And then they seemed very unhappy and worried. So then I said, okay, I'm Dada. Everything is fine. Don't worry. So then they calmed down. So then right now, if I had answered you that I didn't really create it, they would be upset. And we don't have psychiatrists here in heaven. So therefore, you go ask Buddha how it works. And then when you do that, tell Buddha, when he becomes enlightened, he should tell the sentient beings when horrible things happen to them in their life. You know, like they lose a child, or they get sick, or they die, or they suffer. It's not my fault. I didn't create that. I try to help beings. I'm very powerful, but I just can't solve every problem. So there is actually such a story in the Pali Suttas, actually. So therefore, Max Weber couldn't figure out how to place Buddha because he was not a monotheist. He was not a prophet of a particular god. He instead was someone who supposedly understood the nature of reality of himself and the world completely. You know, sarvajna, you know, knowing everything. And then, luckily, he said, now that I know everything, I'm happy about it, because actually everything is all right. The real reality is nirvana. The samsara of suffering is not really real. It's less real. It is not. It's not that it doesn't exist. It's there, and people out of ignorance, avidya, they suffer. However, if they wake up with wisdom, prajna paramita, then they are happy. So that's lucky, you know. You could understand everything and then be very unhappy about it and say, oh, how awful. I think I won't even mention it to anybody because it's so bad, you know, the world, you know. But Buddha's view was that the world is fine. you know, of the famous Four Noble Truths, the only one that is ultimate reality or final reality is nirvana. Even though you're a nirvana, that's the only one that's really real. The others are a little bit illusory, you know? And the first, second, and fourth are a little bit illusory, you know, less real, fortunately. So nirvana is the real reality. That's the non-duality, you know, in the original Buddhist teaching. So therefore, Buddha founded his movement, you know, in the context of the Vedic times, that was Vedas times, on the basis of knowledge, not on the basis of faith. And furthermore, he argued on that, therefore, that human beings could not save themselves from suffering only by faith, that they had to have knowledge. And therefore, if you have a view that the only way to be free from suffering is to know your own reality, then the man who discovers that has forced to be what? An educator. He can't really be a religion founder by saying, if you believe this and that, you'll be fine. Because no one else can make you fine just because you believe in them. You have to understand reality yourself. So therefore, Buddha's Eightfold Path was a path of education. You know, Adishiksha, they call it. Trini Adishikshani, the three higher educations. Shila Adishikshani, you know, Samadhi Adishikshani, or Chitta Adishikshani, and finally Prajna Adishiksha. You know, these three educations of ethics, of meditation or mind, and education in wisdom, which means some kind of deep knowing of the nature of reality. So on that basis, Buddha's own claim, and of course I don't know if that's really true because I'm not a Buddha myself, but the claim is that Buddha knew the nature of reality. Now if you look at scientists and you do not accept the Western argument nowadays that science is automatically materialistic, that science, to be a scientist, you have to discount the existence of the consciousness, which unfortunately is their dogmatic claim. You know, it's like a kind of dogma. You know, you can't take introspection as a real thing. There's no adhyatma vidya, because adhyatma is an illusion, and all it is the brain. You know, it's material, and everything should be reduced to material processes, energy processes, and that way you can understand the world. That's the effort of science today. But the materialistic dogma is not actually essential to science. Science really means the quest for knowledge of reality. So the Buddhist claim is that Buddhism is based on knowledge of reality. And I think that does agree with Vedanta in that someone like Shankaracharya claimed that he knew the nature of Brahma, you know, Brahma Nirvana or Nirguna Brahma and this kind of thing, and that's a knowledge, right? So that's a typical Indian claim, actually, an Indian philosophical claim. And it is quite different from a kind of, well, human beings cannot understand, so they have to believe in an omnipotent God who will then save them if their faith is proper, if you follow me. So on this basis, I argue that Buddhism is very strongly, has to be at least evaluated, not that one can demand belief necessarily, it has to be evaluated on the basis of its scientific validity. And for example, Shunyata, the doctrine of emptiness, which has been very much misunderstood as a nihilistic doctrine, which it is not. Emptiness, you know, because emptiness is something very different. Shunyata does not mean abhavata or abhavatva, nothingness, you know, non-existence, because nothingness is also empty. Somethingness is empty, nothingness is empty. What emptiness means, what things are empty of, is that relative things are empty of any absolute core, if you follow me. So it's really a very simple, actually, idea. The idea is that the self, for example, is a relational thing. You know, it perceives, it thinks, it changes, it becomes ignorant, it goes to hell if it goes really bad, can go to heaven if it becomes a deva, or it can become enlightened and become a Buddha. Ideally, that's the best. That's apparently the most fun. Oh. I always make the argument, Lama Lobsang, that Buddhas have more fun than ordinary people, because they have a, you know, they have the four anandas, you know, the four anandas, and the maha ananda or sarva ananda they have. So, you know, satchit ananda, you would, Vedanta people would say, you know, satchit ananda. So, so now take Shunyata, yes. So instead of a religious doctrine, we're supposed to believe everything is empty. It's useless to believe everything is empty. If you believe that, you will probably think that the emptiness is some sort of non-existence, and you will become like nihilistic, like a charvaka or a lokayata, what they called in Buddha's time, you know, like a materialist or a nihilist. In fact, what it is you need to try to find the non-empty things. Meditation on selflessness, Buddhist selflessness or emptiness means you look for the self or you look for the non-empty thing. So, for example, if I'm sitting here saying selfless, 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 that's not meditating on selflessness. What it is, the way you meditate on selflessness, anatma or nairatmya, is I say to myself, well, I think I'm a real me. I'm Bob Thurman. That's the real thing I feel. You know, it's my habitual egocentric feeling. So then Buddha challenges me and says, no, actually you are selfless. This is just like the Upanishadic na iti, na iti. My little Bob Thurman self, which I think is very solid, I must look at it. When I look at it with the Ramana Maharshi style of who am I, what happens is I can't find it. Where's Bob Thurman? You know? Like, where is he? Here? Where is he? It's just a name, Bob Thurman, you know? So I won't be able to, it will disappear under analysis. And that is discovering that Bob Thurman is empty. But who discovers that? My relational Bob Thurman, sort of habitual one, who is just a product of prajnaptimatra, you know, just designation, right? So that's a scientific claim, and apparently when I understand that fully, then I have a feeling of connection to other beings. I realize that the self and the other are not absolutely different. The self is empty of an absolute self-fullness. The other is empty of an absolute otherness. And therefore we are totally interrelated, in fact, the two relative beings. And this is sort of like, I guess, you would say when you go na'iti, na'iti, na'iti in Vedanta, or, you know, in the Upanishadic way, you finally come up with Paramatma. But in a way, Paramatma is the same as Brahma, right? Aham Brahmo Asmi, or Tattvam Asi, that's all this kind of thing. And everybody else also is the same. So there's a way of beings becoming one. There's a perception or an experience of oneness on the absolute level, while they retain a relative personality that changes and luckily, hopefully, can understand also that oneness. So therefore, that becomes, the shunyata becomes a scientific claim. And I argue that shunyata teaching, or based on the insight of the Buddha, the emptiness teaching, is something like quantum physics, in the sense that in 1926, Heisenberg and Niels Bohr proclaimed that the deep reality, what he called deep, that's Gambhira, in Sanskrit, Gambhira, the profound reality, Gambhira Satya, was inconceivable to formula, expression, conceptual control, even mathematical control, and that when you analyze things by taking them apart, analysis means, that eventually the thing dissolved under analysis. So you would not be able to hold on to some subatomic particle, or you would come up to the wave particle paradox. And therefore, all quantum physics people could do was use the surface probabilities of things, statistically and otherwise, to produce things and to deal with the subtle energies of the universe. And this was in 1926. So I consider that materialist science, based on the mechanical model of the universe, caught up with Buddha's scientific insight from 2,500 years or 600 years previously. He made a valid prediction that if you analyze anything, it will dissolve under your analysis. And that's repeated, of course, by many other philosophers, Nagarjuna and so on, and also Gaudapada, and also Shankaracharya, and with Nirguna Brahman, that's the same idea. Everything, na'iti, na'iti means everything dissolves under analysis, which doesn't mean it didn't exist if you don't analyze it. relatively speaking, when you don't try to put your finger on it, it's still there. For example, people get all fussy about Buddha saying no self, and they feel this is really terrible. But actually, Buddha also said no nose. Now, everybody thinks they know they have a nose. Did you ever do this thought experiment? Find your own nose. Where is your nose? Oh, I would say, here it is. I'll put my finger on a surface of skin, my surface of the finger. But actually, I could go to a plastic surgeon if I didn't like my nose. He would take that piece of skin off, and he would give me some other kind of a shape of a nose. So this is not really my nose. It's a temporarily, let's say, part of the nose, but then the nose doesn't really refer to that. So then similarly, where's the line between nose and cheek? That's just an arbitrary thing. How could you can't really say there's no, or nose and brow, or nose and upper lip. It's an arbitrary definition. So finally, you come up with the idea that nose is constituted by many, many parts, relatively, none of which are really the nose. So therefore, it's an unreal collocation of parts, the nose. It's an arbitrary and a relative thing. So that's what Buddha meant by saying no nose. That you, as long as I don't look for my nose, it's, I call it our lifelong hood ornament, like on a car, you know, the thing, like a Mercedes, you know, it goes down the street in front of you. But if you try to pin down and you're, this is my nose, nothing you touch will actually be your nose. So that's the nature of an illusory object, if you follow me. And that's a very scientific, analytical thing.